Mr. Carpenter, where were you born?
I was born in Ely, Manitoba.
And
that was on December the 6th, 1918. And then I guess we stayed there a short time. We moved to Portage, Prairie after that. And that's where I went to school at Portage till about grade 10. That was it. And then I went to, we were farming there. And when the war broke out, I had been on a farm, you know, and it was a wet fall, and it was raining, we couldn't do the harvesting. It was, we'd work one day and be off for 3 or 4, you know. So I quit that and come into Winnipeg and joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers. And that was on September the 9th when I joined. And the regimental number was H6199. And that's about all I can tell you on that, you know, till the time, of course, we embarked, we went to Jamaica, we come back. A year and a half, so 2 years later, we went to Hong Kong. Of course, that's what we want to talk about.
What were your impressions of Jamaica when you were there?
Oh, there, well, I didn't mind it. You know, it was a wonderful climate. It's actually too hot down there to be comfortable. You know, everything's slowed down to a crawl. And sure, it was novel to us, you know, something new. I'd never seen anything like it, like the tropics, you know. But actually, I would rather have the Canadian summer, for instance, you know, which is nice and bright, and it's not so humid, it's not so, it doesn't slow you down like it does down there. Everything slows down, you know, you have to walk slow, you even have to run slow, if you know what I mean, eh? It just can't seem to.
What would you think of garrison duty there at the time?
Well, the garrison duty there, I don't know, I didn't like it because there were so many men, you know, all sick with this dingy fever all the time that you almost, if you were working, you had to be on garrison duty every second day. You'd have a day off, day on, day off, day on. There was no, we had no chance for training as far as a soldier was concerned, you know. It was just stand guard over this internment camp we were looking after. There was really no training period. You know, we tried many times to set up a training program, but it would always fizzle out in a few days, you know, because there's too many men short. And there's always men in the hospital sometimes. The dinghy fever, they call it, dinghy.
And you yourself contracted?
Yeah, I did. I had, I guess a week of that myself, you know. So you always, but it seemed to be, on some people, you know, it kept repeating itself, you know what I mean? Like, they'd get it for a week or so, and then they'd be well for maybe a week, and back they'd go again on this dinghy fever. Mind you, it wasn't a serious fever, but it was, it would, you'd have to go to bed with it, you know, for a week.
When did you return to Winnipeg from Jamaica?
Let me see now, I think it was on the, it was in September, I think it was the 25th of September, or 21st of September, something like that, when we come back, 25th I think, yeah. So I was here just about a month before we left to go to Hong Kong.
What
yeah.
did you do during that time?
Well, the first 10 days I was on duty at the barracks here, just behind, on Albert Street there, I just forget the name, or Robinson Building they called it. And we had, I was there for about 10 days. Well, just ordinary guard duty there for the first 10 days we come back while everybody else, we were on leave, you know. So there was two groups of men, about 10 in each group. And on alternate days, you know, we'd stand guard on this building. Then some of these fellows come back from their leave and they took over and then I went on my holiday. And that's the year or two that I got married in, you know, just about 10 days before we left to go to Hong Kong.
Do you want to describe your leaving Winnipeg and making your way to Hong Kong?
Well, yes, I guess there's, I recall very well, you know, saying goodbye to the family and all that on the railroad. Not at the station, but on the yard. And I know that I almost lingered a little too long, you know. I could have easily missed the train that time. I often wished after that I hadn't missed it, you know. Because you could have easily stumbled over a rail or something, you know. And I would have missed the train, because the train was already moving, and I caught the last car. I said, about that while I was in the prison camp there. Why didn't I stumble over the rail or anything? Anything was just hesitated for a second or two, I would have missed that train. And seeing they went through to Vancouver and they got on the boat right away, well, no way would I have been able to catch up with that train. But that's fate, I guess. You know, you think of it afterwards, you could have easily stumbled, you know? And would have maybe got rid of that 4 years of suffering and starving, you know. But then again, you know, you might have went the other way. We probably went to Europe after that. I know a lot of fellows that didn't come with us for various reasons, and they ended up in Europe, and they probably ended up in a coffin. You know, they died over there rather than die where we went. So it's fate again, like I said. You can't, if it's meant to be, well then, that's what it is. I think anyway.
When did you leave Vancouver?
Oh, I thought it was the 27th, I think. We left here on the 25th, 2 days on the train. I think it would be 27th when we left Vancouver on an Australian ship. Awakia was the name of that boat. And I guess we were about 21 days on that boat, you know, across the Pacific. We stopped in Hawaii for refueling. And then we went on to the Philippines. We stopped there for some reason. I don't know what it was, though. We just, in the harbor there, we didn't come to the shore, you know. Then from there we went to Hong Kong. I think it was around the 18th, I think, of November is when we landed in Hong Kong. That's the first glimpse I had of HK.
How'd you find the boat trip over?
Well, we had a good trip, except that it was a little on the sad side, you know. We had about three or four deaths, I think it was four, that we had to stop for and bury them at sea, you know, the men that died on that trip, you know. It was almost like an omen, a bad omen, if you will, you know. But we stopped four times for like a burial at sea, you know, which I had never seen before, you know, myself. I'd never been in the Navy or anything like that.
Were these Canadians?
No, there was, yes, there was one Canadian. And there was a crew member, some of the crew, you know, of the Awatea. I don't really know who they were, but I know this. The ship came to a dead stop, you know, in the middle of the ocean. And of course, the minister, you know, said the last rites, and then they tipped us, whatever it was, they had a platform, they tilted, and the body slid down into the water. It was covered with a sort of a canvas, and I guess lead weights, I suppose.
What did these men die from, in particular?
I don't know. I think on one particular man there, I recall, I think his appendix broke, you know, and it was too far advanced, they couldn't do anything for him somehow. And mind you, I don't know why, but they had good doctors on there, on board, you know, our own doctors were there. But one of those things, I guess, you know, the appendix breaking is probably, I don't know why, you know, I couldn't tell you why, but, you know, they didn't survive, you know, they died.
What were the living conditions like in the boat?
Oh, the boat was terrible. I mean, as far as the accommodation, you know, there was no, it was so crowded, they should have only taken about half the men on that boat, you know, and we were just crowded there, we couldn't even, there's no hardly any room to swing your arm or put a shirt on or anything, you know. On a ship, if you're sailing along there, you could get seasick, and it doesn't matter how good the food is, you probably wouldn't like it anyway, you know. But they did have a lot of mutton on board that ship. You know, being an Australian ship, it was just loaded with mutton. You know? So that's about all we had every day was the same thing, you know. Now, I know when we first got on that boat in Vancouver, there was a funny incident there. The very first meal we handed to us was tripe, mutton tripe. So that's when, I guess, about 80 or 90 men jumped the boat right there, you know. And they got out, they didn't want no part of this, so they lost about 80 or 90 men there.
They all went AWOL?
AWOL, yes. And when the authority officers seen this, they ordered the boat out in the harbor, you know. Like it wasn't a dock on the side of the pier. But they ordered it out about a half a mile, so anybody wanted to get off, then they'd have to swim the half mile at least, then they could keep track of it too, you know. The searchlight all night long, they said nobody would jump the ship anymore. So that's what they did there to overcome that. Yeah.
What were your impressions of Hong Kong when you first arrived there?
Well, you know, it's sort of a mysterious place, you know, when you first land. Particularly morning we ended up there, and you don't see it all, if you know what I mean. You don't see anything distinctly. It's sort of a fog or misty, and you see the top of the building, but you don't see the bottom, etc. And it's just like a fairyland effect, you know, when you first come there. But I thought it was very nice, you know, except that there were so many new things to us. Like even the people themselves, you know, it's so different in their habits and their clothing, and we weren't free there long enough, I don't think, to fully appreciate and to fully understand exactly what their habits were, you know. Oh, I think I would have liked to have been there, say, at least 3 months before any conflict started, because that way we would have got acquainted with their ways and even with the territory, you know where was what, eh? Like, when we ended up there, I guess we were there about... Well, I don't think we were there 3 weeks when the war broke out, you know? So, there was no chance, you know, then 2 weeks of that, we spent up in our positions to get acquainted with our positions, supposedly our positions. You know? So here we were 2 weeks sitting in these little slit trenches, you know? The war hadn't started yet, but there we were for 2 weeks. And the other week, well, we had off, and the first 3 or 4 days when we got there, we were all CB'd, confined to barracks. And then, you don't get too much chance to get acquainted, at least we didn't, you know, not the men anymore.
Where were you garrisoned?
Camp Champchapeau, they call this place that we were at. You know.
In Kowloon?
Yes, on Kowloon side, yeah.
And where were your positions that you're supposed to fight from?
Well, our positions were off the main island, like Hong Kong Island. And off of it, there was another island called Aberdeen. So that's where we were on Aberdeen Village Island. Like. There's Aberdeen Village. We'd go by sampan to Aberdeen Island. Like. And that's where our position was at the time. Yeah. Well, the morning of when war was declared, or the balloon went up, as we call it, we were on that position that, like I said before, there on the Aberdeen Island. But there was not too much activity right there, you know. It was on the furthest perimeter, if you like, of the theater of war, you know. Like, or say the front line. But actually, though, it was important in this respect that they had actually expected the invasion to come by sea, not by land, like they did. They came over land. And I think our superior officers did think that they were going to come by water, come over by water. So actually, if that would have been the case, then we would have been in the front line, if you know what I mean. But as it turned out, we were in the rear, so to speak. And that was a conclusion they came to, they decided to move our troops, move them into the island, the main island. So that's when we went across there, and we went to a place they called Bennett, Mount Bennett. So we occupied that for about 3-4 days, I guess. And there again, they decided that we were required over on Mount Cameron. There was more activity there, so we marched across, so we went to Mount Cameron. And there, sure enough, there was a lot of activity there, you know. There was some of our boys from the other companies getting hacked up there pretty badly. And we were there in their support. And I do know we had a couple of hectic nights there on that Mount Cameron, which is pretty rough, you know.
What were you? Were you a rifleman?
Well, I was a section commander at the time. Like, I had a Bren gun. And I carried quite a few weapons, as a matter of fact. I had two revolvers that I kept with me, and I don't know, it was just a walking arsenal. And I kept this Bren gun. I picked up a Lewis gun in the way that our section had, which was not in our regular line of weaponry.
What do you mean by a Lewis gun?
Well, a Lewis gun is a type of gun they had from the First World War, you know, and with a drum for a ammunition, you know, holder. And also, we had picked up one of the Vickers machine gun with about 2 belts of ammunition in it, and we carried that along. So that in my section, I guess we had about 12 men. And I know they didn't like the idea of us lugging all this stuff around. But I thought, well, the more ammunition, the more weapons you got, the better defense we'd have. So we carried those things till. Well, they're awfully heavy, like a Lewis gun, for instance, very heavy, and so is a Vickers. Then we had, in our section, I guess there was 2 Bren guns, and each man had a rifle. And like I said, picked up these 2 revolvers, and a couple of grenades in the hip pocket, you know.
How were you provisioned at this time?
Well, that was something, again, you know, we didn't eat regular, that's for sure, you know, and then it was only if we could send a man back in the, sort of a headquarters they had there, and they'd put this food into these sandbags, you know. They'd put maybe a couple of cans of beans and a couple of cans of this, you know, and buns if there was any, whatever they had, bread, and we'd bring that back, and we had to eat this cold. Because we couldn't put a fire or make a fire in the back. So we ate fairly well, but we didn't, if you know what I mean, it was nothing elaborate, you know. It was just, we'd get a can, open it, eat it, and that's it. A can of bully beef or M&V. But it wasn't the food so much, but what I missed most, you know, was a drink of water. There was you couldn't take a chance on drinking the water, you know? And if you did, it would have to be boiled, you know. So, and that's what I found hard to. It was water rationing. Of course, you fill your cup. But I don't know. I always, you know, thought that I could use a little more water in them days.
So, basically, what was the flooding like around Mount Cameron?
Well, it was fairly vicious, you know, I thought. Mind you, I didn't get wounded there or anything too badly, you know. I got hit on the foot, you know, which wouldn't be any more than anybody getting, say, a stone thrown at him or something, you know, but it still was a piece of shrapnel that hit me on the foot, you know. I didn't get hurt too badly. And, I got another piece on the lip here, you know. Just a scratch, a superficial wound, you know. But then there's fellows around me that got hit pretty badly, you know. I remember one fellow there, about 7 or 8 feet from me, and one of this shell exploded there, and I think it was, what do they call these? And I forget the name of this, what they had, the Japs had there. But I know it burst about 6-7 feet from me, but I guess I was close enough to it that all the debris and everything went over me, you know. And it hit the fellow actually that was further away from the explosion than I was. And he got ripped pretty badly, you know, he got a wound right across his back, you know, about an inch deep, you know.
What was basically the Japanese just shelling you, or were they...
Well, yes, like I had no hand-to-hand contact with them, you know, like some of our other troops probably did, you know. And I, as a matter of fact, I've been told they had, you know, but I had no hand-to-hand contact with them, no bayonet or anything like that. You know. It was all distance, like a rifle or Bren. And that way, I think that that was the only... There was no hand-to-hand contact with that, you know what I mean, eh? No bayonet or anything like that.
How far away were the Japanese positions at the Fahrenheit?
Well, on that there, when we left Mount Cameron again, you know, to get back to this, because I ended up on Mount Bennett again. They pulled us away from there and we went back to Mount Bennett. And there's where I had another couple of nights there that we were pretty hot and heavy, you know, as far as, and I don't think they were any more than about maybe 200 yards away then at that time. But mind you, this isn't, it wasn't continuous like this. They'd make an advance, you know, and retreat, and, you know, the same with us, you know, we'd go ahead and we'd back, you know, keep seesawing back and forth on this Mount Bennett. You know. And there I would say, oh, heck, it wouldn't be any further, no, it wouldn't even be 200 yards. You know.
How numerous were the Japanese? Did they outnumber you badly?
Well, this is only figures that I've found out afterwards, you know. But they had 80,000 troops against us there. And we had all told, I guess, with, like there was Indian troops from India, English troops, there's two regiments of Royal Scots. And of course our own, two regiments from Canada. And I guess that with the Chinese volunteers, there was about 14,000 of us. Compared to their 80,000. Then, of course, too, we had no Air Force. On the first day of the battle, the Air Force was... we had five or six planes of the St. Louis type, you know. And there's only one that was able to get up in the air at all. The rest were shot down on the ground. The rest, one of them went up, but he got shot down. So that was the end of the Air Force, that very first day. There was about five... fairly big guns, there were 9.2s on the island, and they were knocked out, most of them were knocked out on the first day, because I think their map showed it, where all these installations were, you know, and like I say, those 9.2s there, they were knocked out the first morning, except for one, you know, it was just sort of a near miss, but it was tilted. And they used it, mind you, afterwards, but you never knew where the shells were going to go, you know, being off-kilter, like it was. The first day, too, was the communications was severed by, they had an underground headquarters, and all the communication wires and everything else came out, it's all in one bunch, you know, like a big log, I guess, they all come out. That first day, there was a bomb drop right on that vital place. Eh? So all communications all disrupted there. After that, it was just hand signals or whatever, what have you. So that first day, you know, they really raised havoc with us the first day as far as that's concerned. You know, they, then about 10 days later, I guess, when they decided to... Oh yeah, they had scuttled a few ships too on the harbor entrances to avoid them coming in that way. You know? So I know that there, when we got back to Mount Bennett there, to get back to this again, we had we lost our commander. He got wounded and they took him away to the hospital. Then we lost our sergeant the same way, he got him wounded, you know. So they took him away to the hospital. And it left us with just a couple of corporals there, you know, to look after a platoon. And some of these men had been used for porters, you know, to bring these wounded men back to the hospital. So actually, I guess our platoon was down to about half its personnel. And And I could see where the corporal was the highest rank. And here in the meantime, all these Navy men had been given orders, I guess, to scuttle their boat, and they came on land, to fight on land. So one of them was a commander. And I don't know the ranks of these sailors too much, but he was equivalent to a captain in the Army anyway. So we asked him if he'd take us under his wing, you know, because we decided we'd be better off. We had a commander in there. So we did this. So that night it was hot and heavy. The fighting was hot and heavy that night. So we lost a few more men after that, you know, that got wounded, had to be sent back, or they had to have help too. Eh? And we didn't have so many medics as you know, as we'd like to have had, you know. Like, I know you see a movie sometimes, well, the guy gets wounded and he hollers for a medic right away. Well, there was no such thing there, you know. Sure, we had some, but not, they were all pretty busy because a lot of wounded men, and of course they have to defend themselves as well. There's no way there that they could say that you were in the back lines anywhere. There was no such thing. It was an island, and the Nips had come right across the middle of it, and here we were isolated on either side. So there was no such thing as a rear lines or go back and have a couple of days rest and come back in again. And that was a hard thing, was the rest part. You couldn't, you know, have a good rest. You were just laying down on the ground, you know, very rocky terrain there. So sure, you sleep for a little while, you can't sleep too well neither when there's shells exploding, you know, one thing that keeps you awake. So that's the way it was. In the 3-4 days like this, and you're so dead tired, and you want to sleep, so sure you sleep. You sleep for half an hour, whatever it is. That was a bad thing, it was the resting part. I think if the boys had been able to go back into a rear line somewhere for a couple of days, then come in again fresh, you know. But there was no such thing there.
When did the battle finish for you?
Well, it was on Christmas Day. We had given our orders to destroy our weapons.
You were on Mount Bennett
at the time? On Mount Bennett, yeah. We got these orders on Mount Bennett, yeah, to lay down our weapons. And so we destroyed them, you know. We broke them up on these rocks. See? Just slammed it on, break it so it wouldn't be any use anymore. Same with all our weapons were done like that. Then we left Mount Bennett, of course. You know, we still had no contact with the Nips as far as this was all done through our own commanding system. You know? So that night we went down below into this Aberdeen village, and they had a Navy barracks there. So we spent the night at the Navy barracks and changed clothes, have a wash, etc., you know. So it was the following day that we reported to the Nips at One Chai Gap, they call it. There was a place in the mountain, you know, between these mountains, sort of flattish, and there was about 5 roads leading into this thing. And they call that the One Chai Gap, and that's where I first seen the Nips, you know, like talk to you and all. So that was the following day. Then they took us that same night and brought us to what they call the Heights on Hong Kong Island there. And we spent the night there in a house. Oh, I guess there was about 100 of us anyway in that particular group. In a little room. I don't think it was hardly any bigger in this area here that we see here, you know, there's 100 men in there, so you can imagine how packed it was. Then there was a sick Chinese woman there in this house, lying in bed, you know. And of course she had a nurse. So, but then later on during the evening, you know, they did take her out of there. You know, but it didn't make no difference, still too crowded. So the next day they brought us to Shamshapo. And that's where life began as a... Were you there? I don't know how long we were there, though. I can't quite recall how long we were there, but I know we were moved from there, and when they decided to keep the Canadians apart from the other troops, and they brought us to back onto the island again, to a place they called North Point, and there was a camp there, and we were there for quite a while. I'd say maybe 6-7 months anyway, before they shipped us back to Shamshapo again. That was the main camp, but there was about 10,000 prisoners there, I guess.
What did you do at North Point?
North Point, we didn't do anything, really. There was nothing there, there was nothing to do. It was just a little camp, you know, right alongside the ocean. So there was nothing to do there, just walk around, you know, and wait for the meal, you know. And there wasn't too much of that, you know, in them days.
How many men were there
would
be in North Point together?
Oh, I guess probably. I'm just taking a guess at this, but I would say maybe 1,100 or 1,200 in that camp at that time.
Were your officers with you at the time?
Yes, they were. Yeah, they were with us. Yeah, they were with us all this time. Yeah, they were with us. Yeah, at the North Point. Then when they moved us from there, they decided to move us back to Shamshapo again. And of course, and maybe you've heard about this airport they were building there that we were working on as coolies, you know. Yeah.
How long did you work on the airport yourself?
I didn't work too long myself. I guess I was on there for about maybe perhaps a month or a month and a half, you know. Then I contacted diphtheria. So I got off with diphtheria and I was in the... supposedly the hospital, we call it. It was just another hut, you know, converted to a hospital. So I was off with that for about, oh, I guess, 4 months anyway. So I never did go back to Kai Tak, you know. That was the airport there. And after that, well, I got on a draft and went to Japan from there, after we'd been there 2 years ago.
What day could this be?
It was in August sometime.
1943?
Yes, yeah, 1943, yeah. It was, I guess, the middle of August sometime, because it took us about 18 days and we had to go from Hong Kong to Osaka. And, of course, that wasn't all traveling time, but that's how long it took us. We were in Formosa, sitting in the harbor there for 9 days waiting for a convoy to go across the ocean into Osaka.
What were the conditions like in this boat?
Well, it was very, very crowded there again. There was 500 of us on this particular draft, but it was a very small boat. It wasn't a very big boat, but I know when you sit down like this, you know, in the room there, another man would have to sit down between your legs in front of you, you know, to have enough room. And there was no such thing as laying back or go to sleep, you know. The room wasn't there.
Were you down in the hole? Or?
In the hole, yes. Yeah. There was two holes, eh? Like a two section to this hole. So there's half on one end. Then there was a sort of a divider in the middle. I know that to go from one hole to the other, you had to go up, across, and down. So,
what did you find the conditions in the hole? Was it more?
Well, it wasn't. The sanitation was a bad thing, you know. And then we were allowed to go up above. You know, there was a latrines up there and toilets, etc. You just couldn't go as often as you would like, you know, at that time, especially in my case there, I had dysentery at the time. So, you know, it would call on you at any time, you know. So, of course, you kept going up there too often, and right away these Japanese sentries would wonder, well, how come you're going so often? And they get suspicious of you right away, figuring maybe you're up to something, you know. But you try and tell them, and I didn't know too much Japanese at that time. And you couldn't explain yourself. So finally, though, through an interpreter, I managed to get this message over that I was sick with dysentery, so they allowed it, and I was able to stay up there. So I stayed there for a couple of days up above there while we were in this harbor waiting, you know. So I was close to the latrine. Anytime I wanted to go, I went.
But sure, you were on deck? And
yeah, I didn't have to stay in the hole, at least, you know. Because this business of going down, but just get down there, you'd have to go run again, you know. So I was allowed to stay close to the...
And what were you doing for food while you were on this boat?
Well, we just ate what they gave us, you know. But I had... this seems funny, but just previous to this, you know, before we got on this draft, the Red Cross had come in there and gave each man 53 yen in occupational money. So what could you get with 53 yen? It's just like maybe getting one can of beans or something. That's about all you could maybe buy with. So the guys were using it as gambling money. So there I was very fortunate there, and I won a bundle, quite a few yens. I had about three and four thousand yens. So that way I was able to buy a bunch of canned goods. And I got them from the Portuguese volunteers. They had from Genoa, just not too far away. And they were allowed visitors, you know, like their wives and etc. was about maybe 40, 50 miles away. So they used to come and visit them. And that's how they'd have these canned goods. So I know I bought myself a haversack full of canned goods, which I had when I was on the boat. That's what I wanted to tell you, that I augmented my rations that they gave me with the cans I had. And then, of course, there too, being sick, you know, I wasn't able to eat too much. So it was just six of one kind, half a dozen the other.
How was your weight at this time?
Oh, at that time, I guess my weight wasn't too bad. Well, I don't know, I guess I was fairly normal at that time, you know, because I had been on a, like again, previous to going on that draft, I was on a ration party in a camp. And that meant, you know, going out and getting the food, like the rice or the vegetables that we were able to get a hold of, and the wood, you know, to use for cooking. So it was a 20-man ration party. So half would go and get the wood, half would go and get the vegetables and stuff. Then we'd alternate. So you were able to get a little extra food, you know what I mean, that thing. So I was in, I would say I was normal at that time as far as weight was concerned. But it wasn't way later that I really dropped down as far as weight. I went down to 102 pounds, you know, myself. But that was much later. I mean, that was at the close of the war already.
How was morale of the men up until the time that you were moving this draft? Did they have any idea of the war?
Well, up to that time, you know, like even my thoughts were that if I went to Japan, I thought that surely in their homeland there must be a better living than what we had in Shabshapofrins or Hong Kong. There it would be difficult for them, I thought, to get supplies and one thing or another. But I thought in their homeland, surely there must be a better deal there. That's what made me go on this draft. I thought that perhaps if the rumors were true and they put us to work on these farms, etc., I thought, well, at least you'll have milk, you maybe get the odd egg maybe from the chickens, eh? And of course, food is your foremost thought anyhow. Anything that you decided on, it had to do with food. So you think of food all the time.
But when you were in Hong Kong, did the men have know about the way the war was going on at all? Anything else that didn't leak in?
Yeah, there was, you know, there was some news coming in, because there was radios, you know, that the guys had cached away hidden. But you couldn't depend on this news. A lot of it was propaganda anyway, directed at us, you know, so it was all distorted. You couldn't really depend on it. But mind you, you'd hope on it, though. Like, we kept hoping on it. Like, for instance, we waited there for 4 years for Chiang Kai-shek to come over the hill with his troops, eh? And he never did that. It never did materialize, no. But at the time when we were taken prisoners, heck, we thought that maybe 3 months that's all we'll be confined. Chiang Kai-shek was at Canton, or not Canton, but Chongqing. He'd be coming into Canton any day, you know, and relieve the whole thing, eh? But he never did show up. Up to this day, I haven't seen him, you know. But that was the hope at the time. Eh? Yeah.
Were you ever? Do you remember the bombing raid by Lion Tigers? So.
No. See, I was already gone then.
Already gone by then.
Mm-hmm. Say just a minute. There was one raid there in Hong Kong when we were prisoners. I recall, yes. So I didn't know who they were. But I do know that they hit the oil installation there. You know, because they set them ablaze and black smoke billowing up. But that's all I know about that. No, I don't. I did hear about other raids later on, which was more effective, I think. But that one, no. They did try and destroy that oil refinery they had there.
How did this affect the men?
Oh, they were very elated, you know. They figured, well, here's a turning point, eh? But then. How many times, you know, that you raise your hopes like this, then you just to get them shattered, eh? Then that eventually, when this has happened so often, that you disregard it completely after that, eh? Like, in Japan there, we worked in a mine, eh? And they were trying to salvage what nickel they could out of this mine. And it was rough, you know, as far as working conditions there were concerned. It was all hand working. You get these little cars and load them up with ore, wheel them down, and so forth. Then half of the other fellows were in what we call a factory, close to the camp, you know, about a mile, half a mile.
Was this Oyama?
Oyama, yes. And, but in the mine itself, which is about 14 miles away, I guess. We used to go there by train. They'd bring us back and forth by train. But there was some of these Korean forced labor were working there as well, like in and around there. But one of them was giving us the news there occasionally, because there in Japan we did get no news at all, whatsoever. In Hong Kong they used to get the news, but there in Japan and Oyama there was no news at all. Except through this Korean that used to give us the news. Like, for instance, this is going ahead again, but he gave us the news that Germany had capitulated, eh? And some of the bigger things that happened, you know, like some of the big raids on some of the big cities down. And this one day when they dropped this atomic bomb, Hiroshima. He comes along and he tells us of a big raid. He says 100,000 people got killed in this raid. So right away we start questioning a little bit, you know, how many planes would it be in this raid? Like 1,000 planes or so? Which it would indicate that, eh? He said, no, he said, it was one plane, he says, one bomb. So you couldn't believe that. It's impossible to believe this. And you would never think of believing it. So we thought then, if he can tell a lie like that, and which we thought it was, well, what about these other stories he's been telling us, eh? So we figured, well, heck, that was all whitewashed too, you know. Germany probably hasn't even capitulated, you know. But that was the only news we got, you know. They wouldn't, no one would tell us anything, because nobody knew, eh? And, except this Korean.
When did you arrive in Japan?
It was the 1st of September when I got there. That was 43, of course. And that's when we landed exactly at the Oyama, Camp Oyama.
Did your ship go to Oyama or did that?
No, the ship went to Osaka, and we disembarked there, and we landed up on the platform, you know. And they split us up. They came along, divided the, this bunch, go one way. And mind you, I'm not clear yet where they went. You know, it seems to me, I was told that they went to a camp called Number 3 or something, like that, Camp 3 or something, wherever that was. I think it was in the Tokyo area. But with us, they sent us to Oyama, our half. And we ended up there on the 1st of September is when we got to this camp. And we came in there by train in this camp. You know.
What were your impressions of Oyama?
Well, it was very bleak, you know. This camp was built on a reclaimed land, you know, for, on the ocean, like along the ocean. They were tearing down this mountain and filling up the ocean. So it was very dampish there. You could push a stick in the ground about 10 inches or so, and there was water. You know? So that's how damp it was. Everything was damp on it. And, but I did think, though, you know, that... I thought, you know, when we landed there, it would be all right, you know, but we soon lost that disillusion, you know, right away. The, when the camp commander lined us up outside, and immediately told us that we'd, through the interpreter, that we'd have to learn Japanese or else, you know. So the first lesson we got was how to count, from 1 to 10, and that's all you need in Japanese anyways. You learn to count. It's going to be all right. It'd be a nice setup. There's a factory. There's this. The mines and should be healthy there. And the first meal they give you, there's another thing that's fooling a lot of guys. You know, you get a fair amount in this meal, you know, the first one they give us. But immediately the next day, they put us on this, you know, well, a very meager ration. There's no way could you work on that. You know, like, it wasn't enough to work on. It would be enough if you were just laying around in the camp, but otherwise you couldn't work on it.
What was your ration made up of?
Well, it had rice. That was the basic on all. Every day we'd get rice, in one form or another. Like it would either be ground down and made into a porridge, you know, for morning. At noon we'd cook it, you know, what we call hard rice, we'd call it hard rice because it was just the rice alone into a more compact. And they have these vegetables that they have down there, these daikons, these sweet hams, yams, you know. And then the potato tops themselves, that was thrown in for a soup, made a soup of it, or a stew, or soup it would be. So then there's tea, their tea again, the green tea, that's the only beverage we had was their, what they call green tea. So it was all right, the tea, I mean. And there was seemingly plenty of that, you know.
What was the mine work like? How did you find it?
Well, you know, the mine work was nice, you know, in the fall, like September. And if in Japan, in September and October is a beautiful climate at that particular time of year. But later on, you know, it gets chilly, you know, cold. And we had a lot of our boys, you know, get frostbitten toes. One thing or another, a lot of them didn't have no stockings or socks, any. And it got bitterly cold, if you know what I mean. Not like this year, we get maybe 20 below, but it's nothing. This would be nothing. But there, like the coldest I remember there was about 16 above. That was the coldest we got that winter. But man, we had piles of snow, put 10, 15 feet of snow. And as a matter of fact, so much snow there that it was on top of the roof in the the roof caved in one night when the guys were sleeping, all more or less in a row. And we lost four men that night to kill me on all the snow coming down on top. So, and it's wet snow besides, you know, it's not like this is powdery. So you imagine, you know, a lot of these fellows still had only the jiggetabbies that they were given to them, like a, it's like a running shoe, eh? With the fasteners at the back here. Well, the running shoe, well, anybody go out in the snow, you know what it would be like, it would get wet right away. I know a lot of fellows, like I said, got frostbitten toes from that. Eh?
Inside the mine, what kind of tools did you have in Rufus?
Well, it was shovels, they ain't picks. And in a lot of instances, they'd give us a plate, a steel plate that we could use, maybe about 6 feet by three. That would help us an awful lot in that. Push this plate in, and you could shovel it off the plate, which would make it a lot easier than shoveling right from the ground, for instance.
Did you use dynamite at all?
Yeah, no, I didn't myself, but they did use dynamite, and we had some of our boys working on dynamite. They allowed that. I don't know how they allowed this, but they did.
What was the sentry duty like in the mine? Were you heavily guarded?
Well, no, not really. The military sentries would take us to the mines, eh? And there they turned us over to the civilian sentries. They were civilian people. And they, all they carried around with them, you know, was these wooden swords that they had, you know. They didn't have no weapons that I could see. And then once in a while, an armed sentry would go around, you know, maybe once in the morning, eh? And then again once in the afternoon. But then they were right there at what, 4 o'clock or 4:30, I think it was 4:30, yeah. When we load back onto the train again, well, they were there again, eh? The military. They'd take us over till the following day when they brought us back and civilian take over again. That's the way they worked there, sentry duty.
So you said you went down 102 pounds of mine. How was your health?
Well, like, you know, I had quite a few things there that happened there that I don't know how a person would survive it, you know. Like, beriberi was, I guess you've probably heard of this, was pretty dominant there. I had it. And probably another evil there was, not dysentery, but the other one that's a little lesser than that. Diarrhea, you know, for instance. Like I had chronic, it was chronic with me. And the first time I had that, I had it for 5 month duration. Eh? And that, I guess, would take a lot of fluid away from the beriberi. So, while I had the diarrhea, well, I didn't have the beriberi so bad. But the minute the diarrhea quit, then the beriberi set in, and it all puffed up me. So that was one stretch I had there, 5 months of that, and another time later on I got it again. It was a little shorter, about 4 months, you know. So, and of course, dysentery once there. Nervous breakdown. But that was at the close on the last 6 months. It took a nervous breakdown. So that when the war was over, actually I had been in camp then for about a couple of weeks, you know, sick with this nervous breakdown. It didn't work the last 2 weeks of the stretch we had in.
What were the medical facilities like in Oyama?
Well, we had our own medics. There was no medicine to speak of, and they relied heavily on vitamin foods. Like, for instance, bran. They thought that perhaps you could get, I think it was vitamin B from bran. So every morning you get a little cup full of this bran that was supposed to augment your rations of the vitamins from it, eh? And as far as medicine was concerned, there was no medicines as such, you know. There was a little bit, but not enough, you know, to cover in general. And then they had a... At the first while we were there, we didn't have no doctor at all. So once in about a month or so, they had a man, I don't think you would call him a doctor, but he was pretty well versed in the medical. He'd come there about once a month and look over the camp. But I did notice that whenever he was there, things would improve, you know what I mean? Like you'd have a better meal that day, you know? But the minute he was gone, eh? Well, that was it, eh? Well, he was a Japanese. Then they sent us a doctor, an Australian doctor, from another camp. They brought him there, and he looked after our health there. And he was replaced by another man, an English doctor. Now, where they came from, I don't know, you know, but they... I know that they came from another camp. So I know that that one winter that was so bad there, so bad that in 1 month that there was a man dying pretty near every day, you know. Yeah, I know we'd come back from the mines and sure enough there'd be a man stretched out there on a sort of a table covered over with a blanket. You just take a look and see who died that day. So that was one of the things too, that they were all cremated there. And that meant that our own wood had to be used, you know, to cremate them. So by using the wood was rationed, of course. They don't use a cord of wood. They use so many pounds of wood, you know what I mean? They don't use, for instance, half a cord of wood a day. They use so many pounds of wood a day. So now if you get some green wood, that weighs an awful lot, where, you know, they get their poundage out of it. But I know that particular time there, when there were so many of the fellows were dying, and the wood was being used, well then there wasn't enough wood then for our camp to cook the food we had. So we were eating the food half raw there for quite a while. No? But the winters were very, very severe there, like I said, even though it wasn't that cold, no, but it was severe as can be in that place.
Were there any other troops besides Canadians in this camp?
At first there was, yes, there was. There was English troops and Canadians, at the first year or so. Then they brought in a group of Americans came in there. That was, I don't know, I'd say maybe the last 3-4 months, you know, that we were there before the war ended. And I think we went there with 300, no, it was 200 Canadian, 100 British. And of course, losing quite a few men from dying. And then they brought in something like 300 Americans came in there. I know our personnel there was about between 500 and 600 at the end, you know.
What conditions were these Americans in?
Oh, they were in good condition. You know, they had been stevedoring, apparently, what I was told, you know, in Tokyo. Eh? But when Tokyo was being bombed so heavily, they had to find another place to unload their ships, etc. So they had no work there for them, so they brought them to our camp. And not far from our camp, I don't know, I'd say not far, about maybe 20 miles or so, there was a place that they were using as a port to unload some of this. Because I know there was one time there that planes came over and bombed that place. They're trying to destroy the shipping. Because at that particular time, you know, they were taking men from our camp to go and unload these ships. And that's where one particular morning there, that there was a Japanese civilian guard again, I'm talking about him, and he used a few of our men to go and into one of these ships to get some beans or something that they were going to use for the meal that day. And that's before the men were assigned their duties, eh? They were still all on a... Oh, quite a distance away from the ships anyway. I wasn't there that morning, but I mean, this is what I was told. But these men that had gone with this Japanese sentry to go get these beans that were right in the middle of this thing. So they were shot up pretty badly. Because I know we lost three men that time. And this Japanese sentry, the civilian sentry, he was pretty badly mangled too. Eh? But he survived. But we lost three of our own men that particular time. Because I was in the hospital at that time myself, and these fellows were brought in there, but they didn't survive. Eh? One is already dead right on the spot, and these other two died during that night. Yeah.
What occurred in the camp in time of surrender? I mean, the Japanese surrender in the war.
Well, in this camp we were in, you know. Like I was saying, we were so skeptical about any news or anything that we couldn't believe it, eh? We couldn't believe it'd be over. Although we were trying to hope it was over, but still we didn't want to dare allow us to hope too much, eh? So it was one of these little planes they call the Brummels. I think they came from a carrier. And they came along and they dropped leaflets, eh? Like telegrams, eh? Telling us it was over, that we'd be back the next day. We'll be back tomorrow. So the next day they came back, and this plane flew over pretty low, eh, over the camp. And I know at this particular time he dropped a sack, and in the sack there was some tea and coffee and milk and sugar, eh? Just to have a cup of beverage. Well, then, you know, you were letting yourself go a little bit. You were hoping then it was true, eh? But in the meantime, you know, all these nips had left, eh? There was no nips around at all. The very second, on the 15th of August this was, well, on the 16th, you couldn't see a nip around there, eh? We were on our own, eh? So a few days again after that, I'll say about maybe 2 days, a B-29 came over, a big plane, you know. It opened its bomb bays and hundreds of parachutes come flying out of there, you know. Food, eh? Clothing, medicine, chocolates, everything you name it, cigarettes. So there was a big hooray there, you know. Then we could believe it was over. And every day after that, for about 3-4 days, they kept dropping this food supply. Well, imagine a B-29, you know, how much stuff it could hold.
Was your camp all marked for the year, or could it help the POW camp?
Yeah, that's something we had done, you know, on the sands, you know. I said, this is all reclaimed, eh? And we put the POW there. And then camp, you know, POW camp. This was all done with rocks, eh? You know, like just written out. Now, whether they've seen this or not, I don't know. And they may have known about it, you know, of this camp. They may have known about it. Probably they did, you know. But I did see a map afterwards, you know, like after I come back, I had a map of all the POW camps in that area. For instance, Japan, Hong Kong, all those places. But this particular Oyama wasn't on that map. You know? So, still they were coming over there, so they must have known somehow or other, and on this map it wasn't on there.
And how did it come about that you left this camp?
Well, We left that camp, you know, on the 9th of September again. See, that was about 3 weeks after. We stayed in that camp for a good 3 weeks, you know, or probably more. And they, one day, you know, they sent a train down there, and we all got aboard the train. And it took off, and it ended up at Tokyo.
Were there anybody from any Americans coming to the camp?
No one came, but how the communication was done, I don't know, you know, I don't really know. But I do know that this train came along, there was provisions for us, eh, that we got on board and away we went.
Well, how was your camp being run when the guards went around? Did some of the men assume command?
Yes, there was. We had, for instance, this doctor, he was a major, I think he was. Well, he took over. Then these Americans, they had officers with them. Yeah. Well, we traveled pretty well all that rest of that day and all night, and we ended up there in the morning. So, the very next morning, it would be about the 10th of September, I guess. So we got into these piers on the docks there, and that's where we had our first meal, eh? Like, I remember this one was pancake and syrup that morning. So then, they put us on a, oh yeah, that's where General MacArthur, by the way, was, paid us a visit there while we were in that pier. Then they put us on these ships, you know, the battleship. There was docked in the harbor there. And just for accommodations, eh, they put 50 men on a ship like I was on a, oh, I forget the name of this big battleship we had there. So they put 50 on this one, 50 on the other one, you know, just for accommodation.
What was your impression of Tokyo at the time?
Well, Tokyo, man, there was hardly anything left of Tokyo. It was all burnt out. Well, all these paper houses they had, it was all, that was all gone. I mean, you just see the odd big building, eh? And the piers, eh? All the docks, they was pretty well intact.
Were there any civilians around?
No. Strangely enough, there wasn't too many civilians. No, I didn't see any, you know. Like, we went through this, like I say, on the train. We got off, and you see a few people working around there, but not civilians. What I mean is you didn't see anybody strolling down the street or anything like that. I didn't see that anyway. And then they, again, too, we were on a boat, like we said, I said there. Oh yeah, I was on this ship, they called the SS Indiana, that was the one I was on. And they stayed there for a couple of days, and they looked after us, I mean, like food, shelter. And 2 days later, we were brought to the airport, and I got on a plane. We took this plane, it came south. So I know we spent the night at the Iwo Jima. On account of the storm, we couldn't fly further. Stopped there. Next day went on to Guam. So that's the routine up to there. In Guam, I had to be dewormed. So I was there for a good 3 weeks anyway, before I was cleared of worms. And then from there, got on a plane one morning. Hit for Johnson Island. We refueled there, had something to eat, and went to Honolulu. So Honolulu, I was there for about 4 or 5 days. I was in the hospital there for 4 or 5 days. And then from there on to San Francisco. Of course, San Francisco, Vancouver, Winnipeg. I got back here on October the 15th.
Did you spend any time at all in Vancouver in the hospital?
No. We went into a camp in Victoria, near Victoria, on the Vancouver Island. Eh? We were there for a couple of days, I guess. And we were there only to re-equip ourselves, like, for instance, with clothes and uniform, eh? which we didn't have. Eh? So, that's all we did there, actually. We didn't, I didn't go to the hospital there.
discharged?
I was discharged in the following year, in April the 6th it was. That was, maybe 4 or 5 months later than what I should have been discharged. I almost had my discharge paper in my hand one day there, after going through all the rigmarole. It takes about 3 or 4 days to get your discharge paper. And they were just handing me my discharge paper when an orderly come into this room. He says, hold, he says, hold that man. Why hold him? So I was a witness in a court martially, so they couldn't give me my discharge. So they took the discharge away from me, and I didn't get it until 4 months later, until after this court martial.
Was this the court martial, Sergeant Harvey?
Yes, that was the one, yeah. That was the one. So they... I stayed in then until after the court martial. It was April the 6th, and they handed me my discharge.
And what did you do? Did you start working right away after you got out?
No, I didn't. I didn't try working until the fall, I guess, that year. You know, this was April. Perhaps around November when I got a job. And I worked at that for about 6 weeks, I guess, over here driving a truck, eh? So I didn't particularly like that job, so I went to school, took up a trade as cabinet making. So I worked at that for a while, and maybe a year or so. And somebody told me of an opening where I'm working now, like a CPR, and they wanted a carpenter there, so I went over there and I applied for this job, and they gave it to me, so I've been there ever since.
Have you ever had to go down and do a lodge?
Yes. Well, I've had quite a few trips into Deer Lodge. I had a bad back, you know, that I got hurt in Hong Kong. My back got hurt. And I was in and out of the hospital quite often there at the beginning. Maybe it kept progressively getting worse. Eh? First time I was in the hospital, maybe 2-3 days. The next time in was a week. Next time was 2, 3, and 5. And it was 13 weeks. Then finally the last time they operated on me for the back. So I was in there that time I was in the hospital 2 months. I was home for 4 months, and I went back to work. But I had a lot of hospital care at that time.
Do you have any ailments or physical disabilities still remaining from your Hong Kong experience?
Well, the back, although I've had it operated on, it still gives me a lot of trouble every day. And then I had these other ailments, like a ulcerated stomach, and I was bothered with that for all the time, you know. But I thought at first, you know, it was just a heartburn, but it developed into an ulcer. So 2 years ago, just about now, in March, it broke on me, hemorrhage, so I had to have it operated on. So, and now, well, I'm diabetic now, since then they found that I'm diabetic and nervous condition.
Do you have a pension at all?
Yes, I do. I get a pension. I don't know what I'm supposed to tell the amount here or not. It doesn't matter. I get 70% they give me.
So, gather a half or a full? Most of you gather a half or a full?
Yeah.
How did you find the guards in all your time in the prison camp? Did you find any ones that were especially cruel or mean?
Well, we had some like that, yes, that were, they were overdoing their duties, as I thought, And it's pretty hard that it was pretty hard to pinpoint one particular man. But let's put it this way, I didn't ever run across a good Japanese sentry, you know what I mean? There was no such thing as a good one. Like, they all had some trait that, or probably they were trained that way, or they probably were told, perhaps, not to treat us too good, eh? You know? But their main weaponry was to try and work one man against the other, among our own group, eh? You know, like for instance, one day the Canadians would be the best guys around, eh? So they'd, one particular sergeant there from the Japanese army, he'd have a single Canada that day, you know, that, well, Canadians were in that day. The next doggone day, they'd be singing some song about the Star Spangled Banner, eh? The Americans were the number one boys that day, you know what I mean? Try and work one group against the other. So I guess, you know, the old usage there about divide and conquer, eh? So they divide you, and so then you were suspicious about the Americans, eh? Because they must be doing all the... The next day, well, like I say, the British were their number one, you know, so there was no, not really any good Japanese in that respect. And the camp commander himself, he was a wicked son of a gun, that guy. Oh.
It was just the one in Oyama?
In Oyama, yeah. He didn't have no heart at all, I don't think, you know.
Did you ever run across any Japanese who were Canadian or British educated?
Yes, I did. I knew this year one particular, the boy they call Kamloops, eh? I don't know his name, you know, but I do know we nicknamed him Kamloops because he had come, I think he was born in Kamloops and educated there. And at the outbreak of the war, I think he was trapped there. He'd probably went there for a holiday or something, you know, and when the war broke out, he was trapped there. So he got on as a interpreter, eh? So that was, but he taught, boy, he says, I'm going to get even for some of the things that they had done to him while he was going to school or something. You know, I guess in them days you go to school and you're probably the only Japanese in the school, and so he was discriminated against, I suppose, so he said anyway. So he was rougher, he was a Canadian, he was rougher than some of the Japanese that were Japanese, you know what I mean? But I guess you probably know what happened to him. He got, finally, they hung him.
What about collaboration was him?
Oh yeah, we had our pros there, yes. We had what we call the Big Four, you know. You probably heard of the Big Four.
Well, who were the four? One was Harvey?
Yeah, Harvey. Oh, I can't, I could name him, but Harvey was one, Tugby another, and there was two more, you know, but the other two I don't think were as bad, you know, so I wouldn't want to mention them, you know, we weren't, I think they were just going along, they had to go along, you know, but these two particular ones that I just mentioned, they were definitely pros.
What would they
say?
What would they do?
Well, see, I guess you might say it was our own fault that we had these pros, or collaborators. We had originally set up a plan, you know, to use six of our men. Excuse me. To act as Legion officers, eh? Like, for instance, take six men. And they were all picked out by us, you know, and they were the highest rank within our group, eh? Like this, Harvey was the smallest rank of all. He was a sergeant, eh? The other ones were mostly sergeant majors. See, there was no officers, eh? So those six men, we thought that if they were to act as Legion officers between us and the Nips, the commander, etc., that things probably might be better for us, eh? So these six men were put up there and set up, rather. And through it, the thing didn't get rolling hardly, you know, these fellows took over, eh? These four. The other two dropped out as soon as they seen how things were going, that they were selling us down the river, so they dropped out. Eh? And like I say, you know, it was our own fault in a way that this occurred in the first place. You know, if we hadn't set up those six men to act as Legion officers between us and the Nips, I don't suppose that we would have ever had any collaborators. Because of this, you know, they got to in close contact with the commander, for instance, and the commander could see, I guess he saw where he could use those men and perhaps make it worse for us or have a bigger grip on us, you know.
What were these men basically doing that was so bad?
Well, it's, you know, it's pretty hard to say, you know, like, I know one thing, you know, which would be very prominent at the time, you know, like, for instance, the commander seen that he butted these fellows up, that he'd probably get more work out of us, etc., you know, so he'd feed these men, eh? You know, more, eh? They were well fed, eh? Different things, like, for instance, one was in charge of the hospital, eh? The other one was supposed to be in charge of discipline, eh? Well, heavens above, a discipline is a big thing, eh? So, in a lot of cases, he could have ignored some of the things that these men are supposed to have done, eh? He probably could have ignored it. That was why we had set him up there in the first place, as a Legion officer, eh? But no, he was turning all these guys in, eh? So they, consequently, they were all punished, eh? In one shape or form or another, you know? And that took a lot of shape and forms too, this punishment bit, you know? There was all kinds of different tortures that they went through, eh? I call them tortures for lack of another word, but I know myself, you know, I got in on this, in their bad grace one time, and they had a couple of three bamboo wood, eh? And it's round, eh? Like so. She had a knee long one, eh? One is here. Just to show you the thing. You kneel on one here, there's another one placed here, eh? And the other one's placed here, right underneath your toes here. Like so, eh? And you, usually whatever it is that you're supposed to be accused of, up here, eh? Like, for instance, that one time there that I got, it was blankets that I was supposed to have cut. I was supposed to have cut one blanket and to use as putties, eh? To keep warm, eh? But that wasn't the case in my case, you know. The blanket was given to me that way. And I had protested at the time, but doggone, go on, eh? So when they had this inspection, because there was a lot of guys ripping their blankets, you know, but so wide, you know, and making, using them for putties. But I hadn't, eh? But anyway, that day that they made this inspection, my blanket was cutting. So I was in, along with the rest of them, and with these doggone bamboos holding the rest of the blankets up. Eh? So for how long can you do this? So I was there for a couple of hours, eh? Well, I know I wouldn't be able to do it now, but I did it then. So things like that, where he could have maybe covered up for you, like he was supposed to have done. If he'd have done his job right, he'd have covered up for us, and that's it, eh? But being given the food, and once they got that, they didn't want to lose it, eh? So then they became collaborators. And that's the way I think that that the whole mess started.
How did you find the clothing, Tom? Did you have trouble keeping yourself well clothed while you were putting up?
Well, their clothing, you know, that they given us was the Japanese uniforms, eh, that the army used. And but in my case, you know, I had a little difficulty there because I'm fairly tall, and most of these clothing are made for smaller men. Eh? The Japanese are. Majority of them are smaller in stature than I am, eh? So I had trouble, eh? I had a uniform, eh? I guess the sleeves come down to here, eh? But having nothing else to wear, well, you had to wear it. Eh? And then underwear was no such thing as underwear. But they did give us a pair of pajamas. Eh? So you use the pajamas for underwear. Eh? You know what I mean? It's, it sounds stupid, but that's what we did. Eh? Then there too, I was knitting socks. Eh? I guess I was the first one to get a piece of wire, cut it in four pieces, and start knitting socks. So perhaps, you know, that saved me from frostbitten toes, eh? That's what I think, anyway. So, I mean, I know I made a lot of socks there, you know. I must have knitted over 100 pair of socks while I had spare time, eh? Well, of course, I sort of regret it, you know. I regret the whole thing happened. In them days, you know, I guess, you know, no one knew just how terrible it could be. You know, I certainly would be the last one to say that I would have known what a prison life could have been. But, I know one thing, you know, I would never, never go over it again. I would never do it again. If there was such a thing there that day there when I was busting up my rifle there, I think, you know, I would have hung on to one shell or one bullet and used it on myself. And I wouldn't go through that again. That's how I feel about the whole thing. I would never, never go through that again, no how. I would destroy myself first rather than go through it again. That's the point on that.
Feel it's had an extreme effect on your life after?
Oh, it certainly did, yes. Yeah, but health-wise, and when I come back, you know, there was a lot of things there, for instance, that I couldn't tolerate, even going to a show. We couldn't concentrate on it. You couldn't... There's so many things that you've gone hungry for so long that your mind was only on food all the time. In your mind, you could see a mountain of hams, or a mountain of steaks, or potatoes, or... And here, you know, this is continuous. I know some of the fellows there, you should see some of the fantastic menus they used to put out, you know, the recipes they used to make up. And this was kept by them just like a diary, a record, they stacks of paper this much, of say about 6-7 inches of paper, with all these different fantastic recipes, eh, that they were going to have as soon as they got home. Eh? And I'm sure that they even when they left it, they couldn't have that. Eh? I mean, it was impossible, some of those recipes. Eh? Although I didn't get to that stage, but I never wrote any recipes out, but I did talk to the fellows, you know, well, when we get back, eh, we'll go to Charles, we'll have a heck of a great big steak, eh? And I'm sure that was the foremost thing in everybody's mind, was food all day. Because you go to bed at night, you know, and here you are, so doggone hungry, and your stomach is just sort of grinding away there, you know, the hunger pains, eh? And there's nothing to put in, eh? So what do you do then? The nearest thing is water, eh? So you go and drink about 3-4 cups full of water just to have a little feeling of being full, eh? With water, what's in water? Nothing, eh? So that, of course, with the lack of vitamins, then you get that beriberi, eh? And water, you do crave water then. Yeah, I would never, never in my born days ever do that again. I would never go through it again.